Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Car Chat Podcast. I'm Sam Morse, and with me today, I have Michael Malik. Hello.
Hi there.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about sort of who you are and what you do?
So I'm Michael Malik. I'm CEO of RML Group, where we are today. And we're an automotive engineering business that was fully motorsport. Now we do all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah. So we are currently at RML Group, and we've done a little tour. A little whistle stop, cruise around, all of the sort of things that you do. How, you know, where did this journey start for you? How did you sort of get to here?
So it's been quite a long journey that started before I was born, actually. So the Malik family has been building and selling custom race cars since 1958. So started off with my grandfather. Okay. My father and uncle both raced. Ray, my father, who started this business, was world sports car champion and all kinds of stuff. So an amazing driver, brilliant engineer. I sort of fell into motorsport, funnily enough, because of that. Started kart racing when I was young, and then came into the business actually as an apprentice when I was 16. So I left school at 16 after GCSEs.
Yeah.
Because I was fortunate enough to be racing at the time.
Nice.
Combined my start my race career with doing an apprenticeship here in the business. So doing everything from driving the van to repairing my race car when I crashed it, which
nice.
Is a good understanding.
That I could see why you might be like, oh, this school stuff seems pretty boring if you get to come and like hang out here and be doing racing and things like that.
Driving race cars was a bit more fun.
So then, you know, fast forward, I guess, a few years, you were sort of working in all the different departments, trying different things.
Yeah, literally went around every department, then left and just raced for many years, for about 10 years or so, and then came back into the business 13 or so years ago. Initially working on the sort of commercial side and did some fun projects that I kind of concepted, you know, Nissan Juke R. That we saw earlier was my first project, which was a really cool one to get stuck into. A few years on from that, I took over as CEO about 7 years ago, and you know, the business has changed a lot. But there's a lot of interesting stuff, as you've seen, and we'll touch on.
Okay, I want to dive back a little bit. What sort of things were you racing?
So initially I was racing Maliks. So
okay.
We obviously had a few around us. First professional racing was in what's called National Supersport. So they were cars that were similar to Radicals, basically.
Right,
so
yeah.
2 litre open top sports car. I did the World Sports Car Championship for a while. I won the National Supersport Championship, did some British GT. A few rounds of the World Sports Car Championship in various different cars. And also did a bit of the FIA GT World Championship in the Saline S7, which was a car we actually designed and built here in Wellingborough.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which not many people know about.
No, they're They're cool. That is such a sick car. I go to some of the Peter Auto events every now and then, and there's a guy, I can't remember what it's called. Apologies if you're listening. You're probably not. But he has a Celine.
Yeah.
And I'd not really come across them.
Mm.
And yeah, he has, I guess it was, his is a GT1. So I don't know how much, were there other Celines?
There was the road car and the race car, which was GT1 spec. So that picture up behind you, that's me. Front of my mate, Darren Turner.
Oh, nice.
So the road car was designed and developed here. We built the first batch and then we did the race version as well. So getting to race that's at Spa 24 Hours, actually, that photo up there.
That is so sick.
Yeah.
So in terms of road car to race car development for something like that, how much does the car change?
That was designed very much with race car intent off the bat. A lot of the programs that we've been best known for in motorsport over the last few years is based on production vehicles. So they will tend to look similar, you know, from an outside, have similar surfaces, but they'll generally be pretty much entirely different, certainly on the underside. One of the few motorsport programs we're doing now is in GT4. So the car looks like a standard road car with a wing and a splitter on the front, but you know, the change to suspension, the whole brake system's different, the engine's different gearbox, entirely different electrical architecture. So they are a very different vehicle, but still quite cost effective, actually.
Yeah. Because that series has developed a lot, hasn't it? You were saying earlier that you raced in sort of early GT4, where the cars, at that point, do they almost just kind of have a wing on and that was off of your end?
Back in my day, they didn't even have wings. So the kind of end of my professional race career was in an Aston Martin in the European GT4 series. And that was a manual gearbox. It had just had ABS come in. There was no aero at all, you know, with those.
Right, yeah.
And they were really very simple cars, but now they're all paddle shift. They've all got a decent amount of downforce.
Was that an advantage?
That was an advantage, yeah.
Yeah.
I went through a few of them. Yeah, I had a few arguments with the brake system. I think three we went through. It was quite an expensive 2 years for the funder, that was.
Yeah. What was your favourite of the cars that you've raced?
Well, that's a tricky
possibly
one.
Possibly for different reasons as
well. Yeah, the Celine is one of them, because that was, you know, one of the highlights of my racing career was 2 a.m. in the damp on new slicks at Spa.
Yeah.
Doing 190 mile an hour down the Kemmel Straight, going around the outside of people around Blanchimont. that is my standout stint for me when I was racing.
Yeah.
Post that, I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of incredible historic racing for people. So this image up here, that's me again at Spa.
Another Spa?
Yeah, Spa again. That's in the Spa 6 Hour, and that's in a Project 214 Aston Martin, which is owned by a private collector, and he's asked me to race that plenty of times.
And nice.
That's a lovely car as well. I've been very lucky to drive a lot of nice stuff.
Yeah. Looking around, and that's a nice, like, sort of different ends of the spectrum. On my left, we've got the Celine, and then, yeah, this Aston.
Yeah.
The Celine, I hear, when I sort of look at something like that, just as I think when I possibly saw a road car at one point in time, I didn't expect it to necessarily, when you see the race car, kind of think that looks like it's going to be an absolute dog to drive. But I hear they're actually really, like, really good.
Yeah, the race
obviously
car,
you guys developed
the race it, car was mega. The road car was a bit underdeveloped, to be honest. So we, it was handed back to Celine to do the end of the development. Never really ended up quite what it should have been. Funnily enough, I met one of our short wheelbase customers in the USA last year and went into his collection, and he had a cherry red twin turbo S7.
Nice.
And that was actually the first road car I'd, you know, been in the vicinity of for 15 years or so, 20 years.
They're cool things. How many did they make?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Is it like 20 or is it like 100?
I think it depends who you ask, whether it's the tax man or the sales man.
Yeah.
I think we built 6.
Okay.
That's the only bit I know.
If you're about to buy someone, there weren't very many. So you said when you know, one of the first projects you're involved with was the Duke R.
Mm.
I remember that when was that?
That was 12 years ago.
Yeah, I remember seeing that thing first, like, appear. I don't know whether it was at Goodwood or somewhere like that. And it's just one of those projects you look at and you go, what on earth is this? And then you see it drive, you're like, this is awesome. I don't know what it is, but it's awesome. How did that project come about?
So that was one of those ideas that comes about between engineers and marketing people over a bottle or two of wine. It was a way to show that the Nissan Juke had four-wheel drive and active torque and it was sporty and so on. And my suggestion that got me kicked under the table by our head of chassis was to try and shoehorn in the GTR powertrain. Nissan marketing quite liked that. And we did the first one we did actually, or the proof of concept, because one of the big issues with the GTR, one of its big benefits but issues is it's hugely complex.
Yeah, right.
It's at its time, it was so far ahead really of most other vehicles in terms of the electrical control and all the, you know, all the systems and how they interacted. So the big concern was how will we be able to get into a GTR and make it work? So we actually made a short wheelbase GTR.
Okay.
We cut and shut a standard GTR, which looked about as bad as you can imagine, but yeah. It did the job, and we that proved that we could get in and we could tweak the systems enough for it to not realise that the wheelbase was a foot shorter.
And when you take a GTR and you knock 2 foot out of it or whatever, I presume that's not quite, you don't just cut it down the middle, remove some bits and then reattach, because presumably that doesn't quite work.
No, well, we did for that that was purely a, you know, driving around a proving ground.
Yeah.
It was basically that simple. In the Duke R, it was a whole new body pan and so on. It was proper in the cars, but the test tack was good fun. Did get some funny looks up at Millbrook.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then you presumably that first drive as well. Like, is it got? It's got all the systems and whatnot from a GTR, but just in a smaller chassis. I don't know. Like, in terms of the electronics and stuff, can it work out? Can it adapt
with some help? Yeah. So that was the big challenge, really.
Right.
The big, you know, the physical engineering is relatively straightforward, but yeah, getting into the electronics and not realizing, or, you know, fooling it so it doesn't know. But what it ended up was actually a really much more fun GTR that you could pitch in. You could do massive slides, you know, literally backwards and get it to bring back, because it was such a shorter wheelbase and a bit of weight out of it as well. So it had all the good bits of a GTR in terms of the blistering performance and the traction and whatnot, but if you wanted to, you could just scandi flick it and do.
And was it quite spiky or not?
One of the customer cars I drove with 1800 horsepower was quite spiky. Well, that was one of our customers in the Middle East, and they bought two. One had 1500, the other 1800, and it was in the Middle East. It was a royal family member, so luckily the rules of the road didn't particularly matter. And he took me out in it and did a launch, and you could feel the whole vehicle just bending, you know, like flexing because of the performance. And it 1800 horsepower is stupid.
And
it
I
really
guess
is.
that's what happens when you put, say, a GTR engine in, and you've got someone like Litchfield, not too far away, that will just go, yeah, there we go, blah 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 blah. Change some stuff, blah blah blah.
Yeah, and well, Litchfield is one of the people we work with.
Oh, okay.
Getting it to work, because funnily enough, the Mallock link with Skyline goes back. So my father started importing them in the 90s.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Because of the link we had. So in 89 and 90, we ran one of the Nissan Le Mans programs.
Right.
We had the link with them, and then through, I think, 91 and 92, what was it, the 32, the R32, I think. We imported some of those from Japan. So there's lots of these touch points that you keep coming back to professional life, which is quite interesting.
That is quite interesting. Do you still run some race team stuff now?
No. We have... So when I took over, we were about 90% motorsport in what we were doing.
Yeah.
That was predominantly world touring cars, bit of BTCC and some other sort of, you know, other stuff. Now motorsport is about 10% of our revenue.
Okay.
So we've got the GT4 program where we're supporting Lotus with that. We still supply all the standard components for the British Touring Car Championship. So all of the BTCC cars have the same front and rear subframes, suspension, uprights, steering rack, and we supply all of those. So that's a way to bring the cost down in the championship. Aside from that, not much motorsport at all. So the rest of the projects that we're doing, they're sort of either high performance engineering, whether that's in battery design or something like that, or continuation vehicles, or the super luxury market with our short wheelbase.
So many different kind of avenues.
Yeah.
With the touring cars, how does that sort of situation come about, and how do you end up doing all of the
standard supply
and parts and stuff? Like, what is that process?
So that was the idea was Toker's idea. And we were actually the second supplier. So initially, for about the first 4 years, all the standardized components were supplied by another company.
Yeah.
We were asked to tender for it, make some improvements, just bring the quality up a bit and make some engineering changes. And I think we're now in year 8 or so of our supply.
Yeah.
Because once it's there and it's done, you know, it's a cost-effective way for the teams to either run at events or build new cars. So when they build a new car, they can either take some of those standardized components off and reuse them, or they ring us and order, you know, a batch of components and build them into their own shell.
Interesting. And how often does the these base components change in the series? Is it like every like 5 years or something?
I think it was a 5-year kind of rolling arrangement. So it got to the end of our first 5 years and there was no reason to change. There've been some slight tweaks over the years. I think they changed the tire spec a few years ago and that put some different loading through, but it's, you know, really minutia stuff.
Yeah. And I guess, do they fundamentally, they probably don't necessarily want the cars to necessarily get faster over time from now, do they really? Or
not really. You know, if something's good, you know, if it ain't broke, they haven't introduced hybrid this year. Which has been quite a big change.
Yeah.
That's the fundamental spec change to the championship. But other than that, it's good, reliable, straightforward stuff. And, you know, the organisation want to make it as cost effective as possible for all the competitors. So why bring out new stuff?
You were saying as we were walking around that even though there's more spec parts and whatnot to try and make it more cost effective, that's not necessarily worked. Why is that not necessarily the case?
Well, I think when these new regulations first came out, the intention was that though it could, you know, it was going to be sub 100k to build a car. Engineers get in the way of that, don't they? Really? So the spec parts cost what they cost.
Yeah.
But I think they ended up being about the same price as a Super 2000 spec car as they were at the time. The benefit now is 7, 12, wherever we are years on. It's the same fundamental bits. So those bits are in the market. You know, there's not new cars being developed every year by different manufacturers and so on.
Yeah.
So that it brings the entry ticket down, basically.
Yeah. And I imagine race teams being race teams, they're like, well, you fixed that. So we're just going to take the rest of our budget and put it into the bits that are not fixed.
Yep. So it works, isn't it?
Yeah. One of the things that we saw when we were wandering around was the Delta Wing Zero Emission on Demand?
Yes, the Nissan Z-Od RC. Yeah.
Were you involved in the original Delta Wing?
So in the Delta Wing, so there's two projects. First is the Delta Wing, which Nissan came on board with. And we were engaged to, first of all, do some simulation to make sure that, you know, the vehicle didn't fall over when you turned right.
I remember that. That was the thing, wasn't it? It was like, just going to roll over.
Well, you've seen Mr. Bean, yeah?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The Robin Reliant.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that was the concern. so we did the simulation. We proved out the concept. We were then asked to supply an engine. So it's 1.6 direct injection turbo, hugely efficient, very relatively lightweight. And then we ended up taking on the supporting with the whole engineering, the build of the cars and the running at Le Mans and post Le Mans. And that was a great, great program for Nissan and for us, because it was, you know, it was the star of Le Mans. I remember it got fired off coming out the Porsche curves by one of the Toyotas.
Yeah.
You know, and there are all these cartoons of the other drivers, you know, lassoing the Toyota driver and whatnot. And it worked brilliantly. And that was a great period for us and Nissan of doing all kinds of stuff. So, you know, it started with our relationship goes back yonks, as I mentioned, but we did Ducar, we did the Delta Wing. And then from there, we span off into all kinds of other crazy PR cars. Mm. So we did a partnership with Ministry of Sound, and we did the Duke boxes. See?
Okay. Yeah.
And that had basically, it was two cars. You could press a button, the boots would open, and they had I forget what the power of the sound system was, but it was the same spec stuff that they're from the supplier who put the sound systems into the club, into Ministry.
Right. Yeah.
And they would come out, and we did pop up parties. And it was proper. So we tested it in the yard. Yeah. So we're sort of round a corner here in my office, and I don't know, 150 meters away from the yard where the trucks are, 200 meters. And it was shaking the glass in my window when we tested it. I mean, it was mega. We did a pop-up party in the square at Le Mans, the year of Delta Wing. And we had some of the Ministry of Sound DJs there, and we ended up with the police sort of pushing everything off when it got to about midnight, because it was there in the pouring rain. But you know, it was cool. We did lots of fun things like that. Just, it was a great patch when Nissan wanted to show that they were fun and doing fun stuff. Yeah. And between us, we did some really cool stuff.
And that is so, like, those sorts of things really stick in people's minds. Like, you see all sort of marketing ideas that people come up with, and like some just absolutely like win, and some you have no idea. When you're, okay, you don't have to talk about the specific ones, but if a manufacturer comes to you and says, we want to make a crazy kind of, let's say, Duke R type, you know, project, we're going to take a kind of mundane car, but we want to do something badass with it. I know there was an MG recently.
Yes.
Similar sort of thing.
Yeah.
Let's say I came to you and I'm like, I've got this car, can you make something insane? What sort of budgets, and I guess it's how long a piece of string, but like, get thrown at these sorts of things. If I came to you now and said, make me something based on, I don't know, my E-Class that I've driven here, but I want it to be mad and it to be Excel at Goodwood, what sort of numbers are you going to come back to me with?
I can't. You know, it's so hard. You know, we've done things that range from, you know, low six figures into projects that cost tens of millions.
Yeah.
And it is all dependent on what it is. But I really enjoy those kind of fun things, and so does the team as well. So we've got an amazing engineering team here who have developed some of the most incredible vehicles, whether that's on track or on road, most of which we can't talk about, which is frustrating. But what really gets sort of the sparkle in the eyes is the quick turnaround. Right, we've got to do this. Do this. What? It's doing what? and it's those fun things that keep the team, you know, really sort of pumped up. And you see the energy when, you know, particularly if it's for a Goodwood or something like that, because you've got a hard stop.
Yeah.
You know, it's like back when we were racing, you know, qualifying doesn't move, you know, the rollout, the first event with a car, it has to be that day. The MG program is a good example of that. So that was Goodwood, which was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that was the EX4 concept which was inspired by the 6R4.
Yeah.
So that was designed styling-wise by the SAIC design team over here, so MG's in-house design team, and we worked really closely with them to come up with something that looked absolutely bonkers. I mean, it's brilliant. I was blown away when I saw it. It really did look ace. But that was a really quick This is what we want to do. You know, this is how we're doing it. How can we get this pretty bonkers idea from a drawing board into real life? And the team did a mega job and turned it, you know.
And what sort of timeline do you have on that sort of thing? Do you get a year? Or I imagine most of these
things... Oh, a year would be lovely.
Yeah, they never are. It's always like, oh, yeah, we've got 4 weeks.
Yeah. Could you just? Timelines are never what you hope them to be. But Duke car, again, going back to that. So the first Duke car from concept to having the first car shown at an event in Spain was 14 weeks.
Oof.
Which is, you know, horrendous. And it's one of those things where I walk around with potential customers and say, oh, this will take 14 weeks, and get slapped by an engineer. You know, that's 14 weeks, that's a lot of pizza
late
nights. But then something like the electric hypercar that we made for a Chinese manufacturer about 7 years ago or so, that was 14 months from first concept, you know, drawing it in this office on a sketchboard. To it setting the electric record around the Nürburgring, which is still a very short timescale.
And that is, like, in terms of, let's say, an all manufacturer, that could be 4 years.
Yeah.
I presume that's why people come to you, because someone, you know, whoever, Nissan has the ability, if they wanted to make these things. But why do they come, you know, why do they come to you?
So the reason people come to us is we are not an OEM, so we're not sort of constrained by some of the process.
Okay.
So, you know, there's all the you know, quantifiable bits of, you know, being very good at engineering and manufacturing stuff extremely well, so very high quality. But it's the kind of intangibles of, right, we need to do this. This is how we'll do it, and a bit of lateral thinking. But, you know, we're 160 people overall in the business. That's probably less than the suspension design team have in an OEM. And it just means that we can be light of foot and quick and turn things around pretty quickly. The short wheelbase project that we've done, the first customer car is being delivered next week. That was about 18 months of sketching and playing and concepting between me and our designer. Program started properly in September 2020, I think. It was COVID time.
Yeah.
A few of us would come into the office with masks on and so on. So whenever that was.
Yeah.
First car was, or car zero, our prototype was last February. And we're now delivering the first customer car. So that's kind of a 3-year process-ish, somewhere in there.
And wind back a little bit before that project, the RML short wheelbase, is that what it's called?
Yep.
Where did this come from? Why? Talk me through it.
So it started off as a very different project, actually. So as we've kind of touched on and you've seen, for ages we've been doing some amazing programs for different manufacturers, but it's always white label.
Yeah.
So we very rarely could talk about what we do, whether that's, you know, developing an all electric hypercar or, you know, a track only variant of a sports car manufacturer's top vehicle. So I wanted to do a couple of things. One was have something that we could talk about and showcase a bit of our capability. Because it's a great marketing tool, because a lot of people don't know what the business does. But it actually started off as a hypercar concept.
Oh, okay.
So it was going to be a Malik hypercar. It was going to be front engined. It was a twin turbo hot V8, no hybrid, 1,000 horsepower, loads of downforce, all that kind of stuff. You know, all the top trumps. Nonsense.
Yeah,
basically, and that's what I kind of realized about 2/3 of the way. So we'd schemed it out, we'd done the initial design concept, we had a full vehicle layout in place, and the engine concept was underway, and I'd raised about 2/3 of the money, which is tens of millions of pounds to develop something like this. So it's going to be a kind of Koenigsegg Pagani type competitor. But then I sort of realized that I didn't actually want to do that. the whole point of the short wheelbase and what it turned into is something that you can enjoy driving at normal speeds. So, you know, in a Volkswagen Golf now, I can drive, if I chose to, I could drive from here to Sidwell Airport, which is 2 miles away, and not drop under 80 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Because cars nowadays are just so capable.
Do it all, yeah.
So I thought, I don't want to do that. I don't want to build a car that you need a GP circuit to be able to enjoy. I want to have something that kind of celebrates the purity of driving. Mm. It's kind of gone away recently. You know, the last few years, I got the F80 M3 a few years ago. And that thing, that had so much performance and so much capability that it's just boring. And I was driving on an unrestricted road somewhere.
Popped over to Mexico.
Yeah, I thought this feels quite quick and looked down, I was doing 130 mile an hour.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's ridiculous. So whole purpose of the short wheelbase is something we can talk about, something we can show, showcasing some of our capability, something the team can talk about as well. Because, you know, we've got all these people who are doing this amazing stuff, but they can't talk about it.
Yeah, that must be annoying.
Yeah. But also, celebrating, you know, that the 50s, 60s era of design, which for me is the highlight.
Yeah.
That enjoyment of driving, that's what it's all about.
Nice. So you secured funding for this hypercar project. Is that by approaching customers?
We did give it back.
Okay. But is that by approaching customers, or is that a mix of investors in RML and whatever?
It's a mixture. So that was, we've got a good, or we know a good client base of these kind of super luxury products because we supply a lot of them. And it was mainly through, you know, the potential customers and people wanting to have a bit of a pretty exciting project.
Yeah.
And that's how we funded Short Wheelbase as well. So, that was a lesser investment, but it's still many, many millions of pounds. And we brought in an external partner on that, who's someone who has got every car there is, loved the concept, wanted to actually have a bit more than just a car. Mm. So they wanted to be part of the journey and define what it is and so on and so on.
That's in terms of, like, when I look at, let's just say you've got lots of money, when you go, the journey seems to be like, okay, you know, you order a conventional car from an OEM, maybe you're a BMW M3 or something, you're like, I get to choose XYZ. That was kind of fun, but then the car turns up and you didn't really, not that involved. Then you go, maybe you order something from Porsche or Ferrari and you get to do the tailor program and it gets a bit more involved. Then maybe you do a resto mod or something, mm-hmm. which you might have a year-long relationship with. And I've heard multiple stories of people, they've ordered a car and they've had this 2-year relationship with someone and it turns up and they're like, oh, okay, can I order another one? Mm. Like, genuinely that situation. They're like, it's all right, but I kind of want to start this process again. And I guess this is like the next level above, which is like, I want to do my own thing.
Well, that's it. Yeah. You get the tailor-made and then there's the one-off Ferrari program,
which you
can do, you know, if you want to spend enough money and you're selected to do it. What I found with both the customers of Short Wheelbase and the investors in the program and the people that we're talking to about investing, they've got all these cars. You know, they've got Valkyries on order, they've got SP1s and 2s and all this kind of stuff. But then they get turned down for something. and they're like, but I've bought all this stuff.
Spent this amount of money.
Yeah. And so it's about having that ownership and having the ability to say to their mates, you can have one of these cars.
Or
having the ability to say, you can't have one of these cars. And the whole car side of it is fun, but the customer base for this kind of market, you know, if you're buying the short wheelbase is 1.35 net of taxes sterling, so it's an expensive vehicle because of what it is, but if you're buying that, you know, that's, it's not one of two or three cars in your collection. It's one of several, and it's about having something that's just a bit different to the LaFerrari that they've got next to it or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And So how did you decide on the spec and what was going to be the base car and all of those sorts of things?
As I said, I wanted to have something that was a bit, you know, purer from an aesthetic and a driving perspective. And for me, my favourite era of car design was the 50s, 60s. One of my favourite cars is the Ferrari 250 short wheelbase or the DB4 GT Zagato or the Project Aston that's the picture of up behind you with those, you know, those classic Pininfarina Giotto lines, you know. So the idea and the brief with our design team, so Jonathan Bowen, our lead designer, and we spent about 18 months, 2 years sketching before we kicked off, it was to, if we were doing a car of that type now, how would we do it? What would it be?
Yeah.
So it wasn't about trying to create a replica. That's not at all what the intention was. It's not trying to be a pastiche. It's our take on that type of car from that era.
Yeah.
So that gives you some, you know, your starting lines, and then it's thinking about how you want, you know, what the driving experience is going to be. How's it going to be? And I had in my head driving from here down the road just behind us. I knew exactly what it wanted to be. And that's a road, you know, my best mate from school lived at the end of it.
Oh, right.
So when we were 17, 18, it was a road we knew quite well. And I knew I wanted something that had, you know, a beautiful, long, you know, non-turbocharged, just leggy engine that had to have a great sound. Manual gearbox, absolutely. So we're not offering an automatic or a paddle shift. Won't do it. That's against the whole ethos of the car. And sort of figuring out what, you know, what we wanted it to be. And that, you know, front engine, that narrows you down to a certain group of manufacturers. So we tried various different Ferraris as the base car from 456 up to F12. And for me, the 550 is at that kind of perfect knee point between a bit of electronic intervention, a bit of support, but it's still your right foot if you want it to be that tells you what you're doing. and I was fortunate enough to borrow Powell's 550. I'll come back to 550 in a minute. But I drove out of here in it and turned into the roundabout and right foot down, and it just did exactly what I hoped it would do. So we had a bit of a play with the suspension settings and figured out what we wanted to do, and that was a really easy decision because it, you know, it did what we wanted it to do. So the short wheelbase uses the engine gearbox, some of the corners, and a small amount of the central chassis of the 550. The reason for that is so we can use the cars on the road in the USA. So that's purely the reason.
Yeah.
From an engineering perspective, it's not what we would have chosen to do, but it opens up in the USA's biggest market for us. 550, I remember back in 1996, I think, when the car came out. Our business partner in RML at the time, Nikuri Kos, Hugh McCaig, he came to our house in, I think it was silver with, I think, red interior 550. Mm. I thought, that is the most beautiful car.
They are so cool. I mean,
absolutely awesome. So using them now as a donor is slightly painful. but, you know, most of the cars that we're using as donors are sitting, not being used.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, some people say it's heresy to be ripping up 550s, but, you know, if something's sitting there and it's, you know, it's in the back of a garage, covered in dust.
How many are you going to make as well?
30.
Yeah, it's like, it doesn't matter, does it?
No.
Do you try and get ones that have been like, does the customer generally come and go, I've had a 550 that actually let's start with, or they bought a 550 and you're like, just get a kind of crappy one? Or how does that work?
We've got a pretty detailed spec of what it needs to be.
Okay.
It doesn't need a nice interior or nice bodywork, you know.
Yep.
It wouldn't be. So our pricing includes a donor car, so we will source the donor car. The amount that 550s have gone up in the last 3 years, particularly in the USA, has not helped the business case, but there we go. So it wouldn't be sensible to go and buy an absolute minter, because that is just a waste. So the fundamentals need to be right. You know, we do engine tests on them all and so on, and various test through the whole vehicle. But the elements that we keep need to be robust. But everything, whether it's good or bad, goes through a full rebuild anyway. So the engines go into our powertrain department. They're stripped back to the cylinder liners. They're dyno tested before that. First of all, rolling road tested, then dyno tested to give us a baseline. Then even if the engine was serviced a year ago, we do the full strip and rebuild just to make sure everything's right. And interestingly, when the 550 came out, I think it was 479 horsepower was the brake horsepower figure in the manual.
They said,
Every car, whether it's a dyno car or a reference car, we've tested has been about 410 to 420.
Oh, really?
But they're old, you know. The horses run over 20 odd years. Yeah. The rebuilt ones are all between 470 and 475. So that's probably the closest I've ever been to that figure.
That number.
And that's plenty power-wise, actually. Funnily enough, when we did the first media tests back in February, March last year, it was actually only getting 3/4 throttle.
Oh, really?
And no one noticed, which was a relief. but it's because it's a pared back, enjoyable driving experience. It's not just flat out. So it felt fast, even only getting that, which was
that's a good one. Yeah. And did you know at the time that it was only 3/4 throttle?
I thought it was half.
Yeah. Okay,
but we were a bit committed at that point.
But
it was fine. So back to donor cars. That's what we do with the engines. The gearboxes go through a full strip, full crack testing, full rebuild. There's some changes that we make as well. So every component goes through that process. Mm. Anything that we reuse, and again, even if it's if it was serviced 2 weeks before we bought it. There are a couple of customers who have got their own cars. We will source cars from the territory that the car's going to. So USA cars, we will purchase donors in the US, ship them back over here, do the work, which is, it's a new car build, but it's technically it's a can be a restoration or something like that for North America. It then goes back in. We've got a couple of cars in the customers in the Far East who have got 550s that are registered there, so we will be using that, bring that back in. It just helps smooth things out.
Process. Do they have to do with any of these? Do you have to sort of pay some sort of import or VAT or anything like that in the middle of these processes?
They're leaving anyway, so it's it's in and out, so it nets out.
With the with the engine, so is the engine pretty much the same, or have you sort of rejigged it a bit?
It's basically blueprinting the 550 standard engine, so it's putting it back to as it should be.
And the weight of the cars, what are they sort of coming out at?
Some kilos less than a 550. I can't remember.
Is it like 100 kilos, 200 kilos?
Between one and two. Yeah, about 200 kilos. So the whole body construction is, there's the steel lower central chassis, which is carried over and modified from a 550. Everything up and out of that is a two-piece carbon fiber tub, effectively. So it is like a McLaren or a Ferrari hypercar, whatever, in terms of construction of the body. It just looks old. So the whole front and rear, both front and rear clams together, not including the closures, weigh 42 kilos. So incredibly lightweight. And that includes the integrated sort of safety structure as well. So there's not, a steel roll cage like you'd see in some things. It's all contained within the carbon tub. So, it is a modern construction method. It's just got a bit of old Italian steel at the bottom of it. It just looks like an older style car.
It's a cool thing. It's a cool thing. I'd love to have a go at some point. We can talk about that some other time.
Well, the best that you haven't seen the car that's shaking down today. So
no.
That is bright metallic yellow with sapphire blue stripes and blue and yellow.
And is that
interior.
Is that customer car number?
That's number one.
Number one.
Yeah.
That is a good spec.
It's mega.
How would you spec are you having one?
I am planning on never selling Car Zero.
Okay.
Our prototype
car. And will that stay the same Okay, slightly separate question. If you were going to spec one from zero, how would you spec yours? And how much latitude is there in spec for customers?
Well, that's what I did with Car Zero. So Car Zero was my spec, you know.
Yeah.
So that's our take on Tour de France Blue.
Yeah.
It's actually being registered as Malek Blue now. So we did 17 different versions in our paint shop here, coming up with exactly the right mix. And so it looks fairly TDF-ish, but then you get it in light and it's got the deepest pop. It just looks awesome. So the paint shop guys did that here, and yeah, that's being registered. And actually one of our customers is using Malek Blue on their, I think it's a Bugatti Bleed and a Bentley something as well. So
that's cool.
We've had to give them samples of Malek Blue, and that's because they want it to match their short wheelbase.
Nice.
Which is cool.
That'll be cool getting them all together. Yeah, I'm sure that'll happen at some point.
No, that's the plan. So that's Blue over tan, basically, is the spec of short wheelbase Car Zero. So that's our prototype. That's the test hack, if you like. That's a proof of concept, which is directionally, it's the same spec as a customer car, but the customer cars are, or the customer specification vehicle is so far ahead of Car Zero, just in terms of all the elements that make a car what a car needs to be. So,
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You know, the fit and finish, the door shuts, all the touch points. You know, everything is bespoke on the interior, for example. But the prototype car, it's going to be roughly like this, and using the right materials, but just not quite right. So the refinement on the production spec cars is mega, which means I'm going to have to spend a fortune uplifting Car Zero to get it up to where it is, because it's actually now almost damaging because it's so far off. Exactly, yeah. But it's been quite fun doing that specing process with the guys, with the customers.
Yeah.
And it varies from, you know, one of the cars, the car three, the grey one that you saw.
Mm-hmm.
That was one phone call, and he said, I want it to look like the one in the brochure. That's it, which was dark grey, red and black leather interior, bright chrome. The yellow one, we went through seven or eight different yellows, same number of blues, all the different leather options, and that was actually outside of our standard offering of leathers, and coming up with that. Then we had to do stitching for the Malek shield and the headrest in a contrast, and contrast stitch, and you know, an additional stripe on the center console and all that kind of thing. Because we're building 30 cars, and because it's they're hand built still, we can be, you know, pretty much entirely flexible. We offer a standard offering of leathers. There's, I don't know, 20 or so that they can choose from, but if they want to go outside that, that's fine. We've got three sort of chrome finishing options, which is a bright chrome, kind of a satin chrome called Noble Chrome, and black as well. Colours is any colour that you want. Because we do all the paint in-house, we mix it all up, so we'll do various different samples. And it's been quite fun going through that process with some of the customers and the variants. You know, it goes from, yes, I'll have that, to, you know, one of the cars actually went through paint, and then he spent 2 months deciding if he did actually want that color.
Fair.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a fun process. And I mean, car one, I wasn't sold when it was the first. Really metallic yellow and blue stripes. Yeah, let's do that. And blue and yellow interior. But that way it looks mega. It was going to have rose gold metalwork at one point, but it's fortunately not, because I think that may have been a step too far.
These things are so tricky though, because if you'd asked me to spec a car maybe 3 years ago, I think it would have come out very much like yours, you know, like a dark blue tan. I would have been ummed and ahed about that specific type of blue, because maybe this is the sort you can tell me that goes through your head. When I might look at like TDF and go, well, I quite like TDF, but like it's not that blue when you actually look at it. It can be really dark. So like then you go down the wormhole of what exact paint, and you're like, well, that gets tricky.
Yeah, like someone, I want a grey car.
Yeah.
Right, which grey?
Which grey?
which one of the hundreds of greys would you like? Yeah.
But then you get like, I imagine your customers are definitely in this category. They've spec'd a lot of cars. They own a lot of cars. So they've probably done, if it was me, I've done 4 navy tan cars. I might have done a green tan car. And then you're like, right, okay, now we need to start mixing this up, because I can't have them all the same. So then you kind of go, my brain can't compute the specs that people come up with, because I'm just like, well, obviously that looks horrific. And then it turns up and you're like, I mean, I didn't think that version of pink with that whatever yellow interior or whatever it is, I didn't think it would look good, but I kind of it.
It works.
It's kind of cool.
Well, I think what tends to happen with us and with other people, so our specing process is, we've got what we call the lookbook, which is a big square book over there.
Yeah.
That's got 10 different versions of the car in different specs, you know, just to give some inspiration. Different stripes, all that kind of stuff, different interior, some full Alcantara interior from some leather. Blah, blah, blah. So we'll send them that, ask them for their initial thoughts. You know, what roughly do you want? Then we'll do a one-to-one session with the designer, and it's all on in a sort of online configurator type thing, but with full virtual reality, and it does full rendering as it goes.
Cool.
So quite often there'll be, I want pink and blue.
Yeah.
Whatever. But we tend to sort of guide to get the right versions of those to make it complementary, work. And that's the same with every manufacturer. You know, no designer wants to see a version of their vehicle that isn't good. And you can get most things, you know, to work together well, as long as you get the right tones of things. So there tends to be quite a bit of hand holding and nudging in the right direction. And you can, some of the craziest combinations that you think of do actually turn out looking really good. And that's just because it's the right tweaks and the right versions of those little bits.
Yeah, exactly. Like having someone whose eye is like spot on for getting combinations right, and having unlimited choice is a nice idea. But when I know, for example, if I'm speccing something, even if we just look at this thing in front of us, it's like, oh, okay, it's black, and then we've got silver hardware, and we've got one bit of gold hardware, and you're like, maybe I want that, maybe I don't want that, but like, I have no idea whether it looks rubbish or not. And then someone might be able to go, yeah, probably don't mix those two or something, or what about this?
Yeah,
and you just adjust the hues
of
the different things, and they get a bit closer, and you're like, oh, yeah, okay.
I'm quite boring when it comes to my specs. I think all the cars I've had over the last few years have just had all black interiors.
Right.
Black. But that's mainly because of kids, actually.
Yes.
Kids and a dog.
It's clean.
Leather. It hides it well. Yeah.
You guys have done some sort of continuation series for some manufacturers.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's a sort of similar sort of process. The manufacturer might be able, would manufacturers be able to do some of these things?
Well, one of the first two big continuation programs were Aston Martin and Jaguar with the E-Type.
Yeah.
And Jaguar did a chunk of it in-house.
Okay.
In their classic area.
Right, yeah, yeah.
The
yeah.
Aston programs were managed by Aston Martin Works over at Newport Pagnell.
Yeah.
Just down the road from here, actually. Which is actually where Ray, my father, started his
career.
He started as an apprentice at Newport Pagnell. But they tend to work with partners and specialists, which is the same as if they're doing a modern car.
Yeah.
You know, no car company does everything themselves. You know, they work with partners on powertrain or on suspension or ABS or da da da. So it's the same with continuation cars to a greater or lesser extent. And we have supported a few different manufacturers to different extents. On some programs, we were responsible for chassis and body and suspension and so on. For one of our other programs that we're supporting that manufacturer with their relaunch, and we are responsible for the whole vehicle. So we will literally pull everything together and have a car rolling off the end of the production line every couple of weeks.
And how does that sort of work? Someone comes to you and says, okay, I want you to make a car that looks exactly like this, possibly spec-wise. Literally, I want you to make one of these cars. And then you're like, cool, we can do that. How do you go from there's a car to,
so
presume you don't get the CAD files?
No. The filing systems in the 50s and 60s weren't great. it does vary a bit. So what we have done with programs we've been involved in, we have had access to a couple of the original cars. We have scanned those. We've gone through. The team do months of research, which is mainly from books and our videos and photos and all this kind of stuff, to look at what the cars, that, you know, that vehicle was in period, and understand what that is. By the end of it, if there's a pub quiz on any of those vehicles, you know, my team will smash it because they know everything.
They know everything.
Down to the colour of the wheel caps on, you know, at this particular race.
And do you have to pick a particular sort of like year, date of the car? Because I imagine, let's just say it's made in Italy, like there might be some variance amongst the cars built, or if some of them raced, then they get different versions of them.
Well, like, the cars that you scan now, if it's a 1960s car, it's 50-60 years old, so it's been crashed and rebuilt seven times. You know, it's trigger's broom, isn't it? It's five new heads and three new handles.
Exactly.
So it's you have to pick what is the, you know, the master sample. And basically what we would try and do. So on one program, we were lucky. We had over 1,000 original drawings.
Okay, cool.
Which was awesome because the guys could sort of pour into them, and they had, you know, the original handwritten notes from the design team back then of the road version has this and the race version it's this metal and it's drilled out for lightweighting and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, nice.
But you kind of pick the master spec. So you have to say, this is what the design intent was for the car in period. We've had vehicles here that we've scanned for continuation programs, and I remember one had a door 3 inches shorter on one side than the other. You know, there was up to 2 inches in difference of suspension points.
Oh wow!
Because they've been crashed, or they've been, you know, put together on a Friday afternoon by a tipsy Italian or something in 1958 or whatever it is. So it's picking that master spec and defining what it is, but then making it for modern times. So, you know, you can't sell a car nowadays that has a fiberglass body and no roll cage, for example.
Yeah.
It's just, you can't do that. It would be inappropriate to do so. Or a car that has fuel tanks in the seals and aluminium boxes.
Yeah.
That doesn't go down well, you know, or it would go up very well. But, so it's a case of picking what the car should have been, and then dialing in that level of safety so it's appropriate for now and usable for now, but in an empathetic way.
Mm.
And, you know, just using better materials, better quality. On the programs where we support with chassis for some of these continuation cars, the whole chassis, from front to back, the whole welded assembly, is within a tolerance of 2.5 millimeters. And that's on a full welded, you know, 4 or 5 meter long thing. Suspension points are accurate to within 0.5 mil. And that's because we can do that now.
Yeah.
Whereas in period, you know, when my father was building DB6s down at Newport Pagnell, you know, 0.5 inch was probably a tolerance. Yeah, not
that's
half
good enough.
A mil. Yeah.
Yeah. I have this interesting sort of like take on when you get a sort of modern, Because the cars, I think, well, you've done different ends of the spectrum. You've done some that are like a take on an older car, but it's it might have a carbon body on it, or and then some are more sort of exact. A car that was built today as like a sort of, let's just say, as a sort of tool room copy type situation, is going to drive more like the original than any original you can buy.
Yes.
Which I think a lot of people look at these things and go like, yeah, it's a copy, it's a, like, you know, whatever, and be like, but actually, it's the purest you're going to get to what it was originally intended to be.
Yeah. It will be better than any original would have been
better,
in
but,
period.
And closer to what it was meant to be than any car you buy now.
Yeah.
Even with a full restoration, whatever, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Because it is the design intent, and with the tools and the people that we have around us and the processes that, that didn't exist 50 years ago, you can actually build what's on the drawing board rather than something that's close to it.
And then you've got the flip side of it, and you can go, it doesn't have the actual history of like, this was driven by so-and-so and crashed by so-and-so. And you know what it's like to drive with your hands slightly adjusted to go in a straight line. So you've been involved in a lot, you do a lot of EV stuff now.
Yeah. Yeah.
What sort of project type things are you involved in that space?
So we've, that's one of the areas we've really invested in a lot over the last decade, pretty much. Mm. So our first hybrid program was the Nissan Zeal we mentioned earlier, which was the first car to do an electric lap of Le Mans. So it did a full lap at the same speed as same lap time as a GTE car, did 300 kilometers an hour in a straight line. You know, back then the battery that was in that was about 150 kilos and it had the same amount of energy as about 3 and a bit kilos of unleaded. So things have moved on a bit.
Not a lot, yes.
And we have supported various manufacturers with either concepting of new batteries that might be coming into production in a few years' time. Or you know, we've done a full EV hypercar for a manufacturer and we built 16 versions of that and a load of spare batteries as well. We're supporting a customer at the moment, which is going to be the highest performance battery that you can purchase anywhere. It's basically a Formula One specification battery in terms of the capability and the output. But at the other end of the scale, we do off-highway batteries as well, and things for not actually even vehicles. Because the battery construction and so on is the same, whether it's going into a £3 million hypercar or a, you know, a automated dolly that's used for testing various systems. So we started getting into EV because, or we started getting into batteries because we couldn't find a supplier who could do what we wanted.
Right, yeah.
It's a niche business, very much. It's the fundamentals are really simple. It's a battery cell. You stitch them together. You stick those two bits together, and then you got a battery. But as with all these things, it's the detail of the integration, how it all works, that makes them either really good or just average. And there hasn't been, or the certainly for the period where we started off, there isn't another supplier who can do low volume special batteries. You know, you've got the gigafactories at one end and JLR are building theirs down in Somerset or wherever it is. But that for a low volume manufacturer or a sports car manufacturer isn't going to come up with the batteries that they need to fit their purposes. So for doing electric Range Rovers, it'll pump those out all day. You know, there's a factory up in Sunderland where they do the Nissan batteries. For the Leaf and et cetera, et cetera. But if you want to build, or if you're a manufacturer building a £200,000 hybrid supercar, there isn't really a good provider there, or there hasn't been. So that's why we've invested so heavily, and that's where our niche is. It's in the lower volume, higher value product, where you know, it's a higher value sales price, so you can afford a bit more spend. And that's where that's where we fit in. So we're supporting lots of different people for that. And the intention is we've got a kind of investment roadmap to put us as, I want us to be the key go-to supplier for those people, you know, for the low volume manufacturers. There's regulation coming as well that a certain amount of your vehicle needs to be locally sourced as well.
Yeah, which is a problem for BEVs.
Yeah. So I want to solve that problem. That's, that's the intention. That's what we've got a roadmap to do. The guys have got some amazing routes to getting a high-end battery, but still hitting the price point that it can go into.
Right.
Yeah, so it's quite cool, quite exciting.
And what sort of things have changed in versus, you know, these a battery you're making for a bespoke, low production type situation with a lot more, you know, you can put a lot more money into it versus, I don't know, your standard sort of, let's say, Tesla battery versus what you, the sort of things you might put into, you know,
whatever. So, yeah, a high end. So the basics are the same. Most of the batteries nowadays tend to be the cylindrical ones. So 21700 or so. It's like a big AA battery.
Yeah.
The ones that Tesla and other manufacturers are using now are more like the big, is it D batteries?
You know, they're fatter, shorter ones.
So
yeah.
they're moving into that, but it's the same basic idea. We've done batteries with pouch cells, which some people still use as well, which is, you know, it's like a big DVD case sort of thing with tabs at the top. Or there's prismatic, which is like a video box. You remember those VHSs?
Yeah.
So that box, so they're like that. But most people are the cylindrical cells now. The big variance tends to be the cell chemistry, really.
Yeah.
And that's what drives the cost of a lot of the cell changes, or the changes in cells, and which drives the change in the battery. So in a BEV battery, you've got thousands of cells.
Yeah.
If you're an OEM, you're paying, you know, cents, sub a dollar for each of those cells.
Yeah.
At our level, it's a struggle to get sub $5 for a cell. Just because of volume and supply issues.
And is that a similar cell?
It's similar, yeah. At the other end of the scale, the cells in the battery that you saw earlier, each of those cells are over £100
each. Okay.
Each cell.
And what can they do that the others can't?
They can pump out a load more energy or power a lot quicker. So that battery system is up to 200C discharge, which is where Formula One is and has been. And that's about a factor of 20 or so better than what's in a road car.
And that's how quickly you can put power in and take power out.
And get it out, yeah.
And does that mean a battery like that, you plug it in, we're not going to see 1500 volt chargers because that's just insane.
Mm.
So in terms of the charging, I guess you're going to max out at whatever charger.
It's the discharge that's fine. Well, and to an extent, any regenerative charging as well, of course, but that's lesser. So it's more about the outflow.
You can charge
out. Of course, is the important bit.
Significant amounts of power,
exactly that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then I guess actually also it must have some charging benefits because if it can take power at whatever, let's just say 100%, but even your 350 volt charger is
kilowatt charger
is 35% of the max.
Yeah,
you're going to be able to put in that at 350 until it's full ish.
That's if you find a 350
that's
working
very many at,
and I'm working at that level. I mean that for me is the issue with BEVs going forward. It's the whole infrastructure thing. That's the big challenge.
How do you see, and from your perspective of being involved in different parts of it, and I know lots of high-end, you've got a BEV that's your daily. How do you sort of see this going in different solutions?
I think batteries are part of the solution, but not the whole solution. I've got a BEV, I've got a Taycan, which is an amazing car.
Yeah.
Brilliant car, love it. I've also got an X5 to drive to our place down in Devon because the Taycan won't get there. And so BEVs are incredible, but there's the cost of manufacture. Then you get into the whole pre-manufacture and the ethics of where some of the materials are coming from and what's the end of life stuff and all that kind of thing. But from a pure use perspective, I still get nervous when I get under 100 miles on the range,
yeah.
Which is bonkers. Because in by the SUV we've got a 911 as well, which is cool.
Is that yours outside?
Yes. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Again, silly. Far too fast.
Ridiculous.
That anyone's allowed to buy it. but yeah, separate thing. But in that, you know, I'll happily drive around with less than 10 miles range.
Yeah.
But in a BEV, it's amazing. The range anxiety that you, even when it's completely irrational. And then you get into, you know, we were on holiday in Devon last week with the family and came back. We went in our diesel SUV.
Yeah.
And when we stopped at the service station, every charger was full and there was a queue. And that's the issue. So for me, batteries are part of the solution. I think we're going to end up with sort of hybridized vehicles where you can have zero emissions in city, but then an onboard charger of some sort, whether that's a combustion engine or hydrogen fuel cell or one of those sort of things. The issue with hydrogen, again, is the infrastructure.
Yeah.
So I would expect that we will end up with sort of serious hybrid vehicles with synthetic fuel of some sort. That would be my guess. Because the infrastructure is already there. You know, we've got millions of petrol stations around the world with these big tanks under the forecourt, which you can pour liquid into, and whether it's petrol or it's a synthesized petrol.
That's
my view. I mean, I'm wrong, of course, because you're always wrong on any of these when you're looking 20 years into the future.
You see how it pans out.
Yeah.
I have a small EV, and no, I did not drive that here today. I could have actually, but I didn't, space-wise. I love charging at home. I like having a full tank.
Mm.
The range is not massive. It's on my E208, it's like probably about 150 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But just literally, I get in that car and it's full pretty much any time I get in it. I never go to a petrol station. I quite enjoy that.
I haven't got a drive.
So do you charge here?
I charge here, yeah. So I've got a garage, but it's about 3 inches too long to fit in the garage. It was quite a bit of a leap really to do that, because I don't have a drive in front of my house. I park on the street. It wouldn't be appropriate to run a cable across the path. You know, but I've got, there's a public charger 3 streets back from my house.
Okay. So
that's my fallback that I go there. But yeah, when I was walking, when the onboard charger failed in January, and I was walking back in the rain, albeit for 2 minutes, but in the sleet, that takes the shine off that.
That's not the optimum solution.
What's interesting is I found myself driving differently in everything on the road now.
Yeah.
Much more sensitive to throttle inputs and all that kind of stuff. I've always been quite a good driver, you know, because that's what I do. But I've noticed that I'm much more sensitive to that. And it's funny, when my wife drives the car, it's about 20% more energy she uses.
Really?
Because it's, you know, more the traditional on-off, on-off.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the guys did take one of our customers down to the airport in it the other day and got used 50% less energy than I've ever used.
Wow.
But I think that's more to do with the speed.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how it changes, or for me, how much more attuned to using energy I've been in on the road, which has got to be good all round, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's actually a really interesting effect I've found. It's like, I know a lot more about energy now because I'm tangibly, I know what's going in. And we don't have these weird mix of units that we seem to have in the UK with like gallons, but I put it in litres and all that sort of stuff. So you don't really, like, you know, you're using less or more, but in an EV, because they're so efficient, if you're driving inefficiently, you knock off so much range.
Mm.
So you get that instant feedback of like, oh, okay. And it's kind of like, but I might not get there if I drive inefficiently. Where the petrol car, it's the same stuff, but you're not attuned to it because you're used to just filling up when you fill up.
Well, and because you've got 300 miles.
And you might have 300 miles.
500
or miles,
whatever it is. So it's less of an issue. So using that bit more energy, it doesn't matter. But when you're using 5% more energy and you've only got half the range, that's like using, you know, 10% or 20% of a 600-mile tank.
Yeah.
Well, it's the difference between 65 and 70 mile an hour as well.
It's a huge difference. Mm. And
wind and air are horrible things.
Who'd have thought?
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a mental one, actually. And especially all cars nowadays, or not all cars, lots of people drive big SUVs.
Mm.
And their aero profile
mm.
means that your 65 to 70 is a huge difference. Whereas if it was all super slippery concept car-y type stuff, yeah. you would have a significantly less
of an effect. But no, it's massive. But stick your hand out the window at 70 mile an hour.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah.
You're like, oh yeah. It's quite solid.
Yeah. I keep telling the kids that. I'm trying to educate the kids on it and get their understanding of what it all means. What do you mean the air's slowing us down?
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Right, so I normally wrap these up with five questions. Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
Yes. So when I was 18, me and two of my best mates went to do a ski season. In Val d'Isère. Did you really? Well, we got sacked after a week, so it didn't work out very well. But we went out there. One of the guy's fathers had a garage that was a Jeep dealer. So we had a Grand Cherokee, so a few years old.
Yeah.
You know, not quite the wooden down the sides, but an older one. And for some reason, I think that we went on the tunnel and the cheapest one was at sort of 5 in the morning. So we left Northampton at 2 a.m. I was like, for some stupid, oh, it's much cheaper, we'll do that. So drove through the night and we were... where were we? Somewhere in France near Annecy or whatever, coming down a hill and it's been a boring old drive. And three of us and a load of bags, suitcases in the back. And we're like, right, let's do a high-speed challenge. Let's see what we can get out of the old Cherokee. So there's a big, long, straight road. There's a truck half a mile in the distance or something. Downhill, mega, right, windows up, aircon off.
Yeah.
Down we go. It's like 112.
Oh,
115. Oh, God, look at it. And then the lorry in front of us got to the roadworks. So I pulled into the fire into our lane. So I jump on the anchors, big old one of these. And my mate who was in the back got an imprint of a suitcase in the back of his head. So probably not the answer you were expecting.
Yeah.
But that came straight to mind.
Nice. I can't remember what it was. Actually, no, it was a set of skis. What is it about ski trips that imprint this in your head? That slamming on the brakes.
Literally imprint it.
Slamming on your brakes with stuff in the car. If you've got a set of skis like slotted down in between the seats and you slam on the brakes, it didn't quite go through the windscreen, but it was close enough. And I think that whoever was the passenger like leant across and managed to like catch the tips of these skis before you're like, okay, so I now put the net up in the back of the car more often than not. Yeah. Funny times. If you could only drive one sports car for the rest of your life, what would it be?
That's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we've got 911, like I said.
Turbo S.
Cracking thing. Car I've wanted since one of my best mates' dads got one when we were about 13.
Oh, nice. Okay, so how's the reality been?
It's an incredible car. It's phenomenally capable. It's ridiculous that you and I and anyone else can just go and buy that car and be allowed to drive it. But it's just mega. It just does what it does, and you can. I've had four kids and a Labrador in it, and 36 bottles of wine in the front boot, I think. So it's a really good car. I had a current generation Vantage a few years back.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it, wasn't finished as a vehicle.
Yeah.
Missed that last bit of development, didn't it? You know what I mean. It's got those little squeaks and rattles, and wasn't quite right. I really miss it now because it's got so much more character.
Right, yeah.
And the day I moved it on, it was January, 7 degrees, drizzling, and I went for a quick blast in the just out and around the country roads that I know. And it's brilliant. I loved it. And I can't do that in the Turbo S.
Yeah.
Because it's got so like, much capacity.
It's too good.
It is, yeah. I took it on track at Silverstone, actually, the nice. Turbo S. And I did one time lap with a pal in the passenger seat on road tyres, literally as it is now. And it was 10 seconds off the GT4 race car lap record. I mean, it's
yeah.
Yeah, it's so
mind-boggling.
So I don't know. Do I want a sports car that's... Is it my only car?
This is your...
Or you've only
got
sports
a,
car?
You've got like a banger on the side that you can chuck luggage in and whatever.
Yeah, I might go Vantage.
Nice.
Just silly, fun.
I'm really looking forward to... Like a current gen.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to this sort of reinvigoration of the cars that seems to be coming with DB12. And I'm hoping the Vantage gets like a similar sort of like kind of slightly rowdiness improvement.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure will happen in infotainment and whatnot.
It needs it. DB12's mega, isn't it? It's a big step.
I've not driven one yet.
I've not driven it yet, but I've heard really good things. And the DB11 drove really nice, particularly the V8.
Mm.
The V12 had too much suspension movement and fully sort of
doing
like that. You've got a load of basically torque steer almost when nice. You got on the gas. But yeah, I had a look at the DB12 the other day. I was in New York and walked past. They've got a new Q thing in New York, and it's really nice. It's got infotainment that does actually look like it works and so on. Because that's the bit that's been missing for Aston for the last 15 years or so, 20 years.
You look in a DBS. And a friend of mine had a DBS Volante for like a week. He was writing an article or whatever. And I think at the time I had an 812, around about that time. And like you put the two next to each other and like the DBS is a sick looking car.
Yeah.
And on paper, you're like, it's cool. And then you get in the interior and you're like, no. This is not the same category. It's what the Ferrari interior was at the time.
Yeah.
And it feels like with the DB12, it's there. It's like, oh yeah, cool, great. Yeah. Now we can sort of stop talking about the infotainment and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Although, at least it hasn't got those funny haptic buttons everywhere. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Ferrari's gone too far. Everyone's gone too far on that.
Well, this is part, on short wheelbase, this is part of what I wanted to do is so everything has an actual button that does something. It's got a 7-inch screen. If you press a button, a glass and an aluminium button, it comes up out the dash.
Okay.
It's got Apple CarPlay, it's got reversing camera, it's got all your touchscreen stuff on there, but if you don't want that, that's not there.
But not also the way the Vantage and maybe like a Cayenne has of like 4,000 buttons.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's about 8 we've got down in the center. So
that sounds like a good amount. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What should be worth more?
RML short wheelbase.
Yeah, obviously. Outside of RML.
The whole values of everything seem to be bouncing around all over the place over the last couple of years.
Tricky.
Yeah. Aston Martin V8s from the 70s and the early 80s.
Not driven one, but I like them. Yeah. I've not driven one.
Do you need to drive one? They just look mega.
I think that's probably what you do with them. Yeah. You drive them, but they're just wafting around.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, they just look really good.
I think that sort of shape, that sort of boxy design is so much, like I think it's when you look at supercars and then how they fit in with modern normal cars or normal cars of the period. At that time, everything was boxy. So they're like, they're kind of the same. But we've got now all of our modern cars are all swoopy and not the supercars because they've all gone a bit like, but sort of swoopy, blancmange cars. Whereas you put all these boxy cars in the middle of them and you're like, oh,
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So I love what Aston done with the Valor.
Mm.
That's that's cool for me.
And the Victor before.
Yeah.
I've not seen the Valor. I didn't go to Goodwood. But the Victor, when I saw that, I was like, whoever thought of this and came up with this, this is sick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most interesting car to you at the moment? Googling, looking up. I guess it's possibly a project.
The most interesting bit for me is actually the technology that's around in stuff. So I'm not particularly fascinated by anything at the moment. There are certain elements that do fascinate me.
Mm-hmm.
So things like what Tesla have done with the cost of battery systems.
Right.
That kind of thing. Because I know how complex they are and how expensive they are, and they should be. And seeing how, you know, Tesla, I'm not a fan of the product.
Yeah. You know, I don't really like them.
We had a Model S for a bit a few years ago, and my daughter came and sat in the passenger seat, and within half a mile she said, why does this feel like a toy car? Because it does, doesn't it? You know, it's an amazing tool, but it's missing a lot of that sort of quality thing. So I'm not a fan of them from that side, but what they have done
unbelievable
is coming in from nothing to being one of the world's largest manufacturers of anything.
Yeah.
At a price point, and they have made electric cars accessible and cool. Yeah. And that's what has impressed me.
That's it. I look at them and go, I drove a Model 3. It's like, let's see what this is like. And I didn't really gel with it. But I look at what exactly at that, the technology, what they're pushing, the way they're pushing their processes and simplification of systems and control systems in the car, all that sort of stuff, I find really interesting. And the way they've done all these gigapresses and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Like, people used to look at EVs and go, oh, they're really expensive and blah, 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 blah. Well, now you look at a Model 3 and like, relative to another new car, they're really not expensive. Mm. And they're going to be making a cheaper car than that.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, this is genuinely making transport cheaper for everyone.
Yeah. And that's amazing.
Which is really cool.
We've got two Model 3s here, two of my directors have got them. And what they are for the catch, because what's a Golf now? You spend over 40 grand on a Golf really 100%. Easily. That's what's impressed me, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. Five car garage, unlimited value.
God, you could have told me these questions before.
No, the whole point is I don't tell you.
DB4 GT Zagato.
Nice.
RS6.
Yeah.
Which I had one, loved it.
Yeah. Why did you get rid of it?
Because someone let themselves into my house and took the keys and then took the car.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So it went, yeah.
So I didn't get rid of it. Someone else did.
Unfortunate.
4 GT Zagato, RS6, some silly modern 1,000 horsepower.
Which one?
Thing.
Which one?
812 GTS, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Nice car. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. What's that? Three.
That's three. You could have, I guess you've sort of got a race car, but like you could have a race car. You could have I don't know.
I would say if it's toys all round, I would have a Malek Clubman's car.
Nice.
To play with and go use on the track because heritage and mega things, etc. I should have a BEV, shouldn't I? I guess.
Maybe.
Good to cover all bases.
Yeah.
I'd go Taycan.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll go GTS, which is one I ordered but I couldn't get.
Okay.
Taycan, Sport Turismo.
Nice.
GTS. Just
I'm really...
Nice wafting car. Actually, no, mate, no. Spectre.
Oh.
Yes. That's the one, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Because that's proper wafting. Isn't it?
Yeah, that's cool. Right, there we go. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
That's been good.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.